and welcome to System Fix, a podcast from the health media. My name is Barbara Fountain and I am the editor of New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa. System Fix takes a look at changes proposed to the New Zealand health system and progress with implementing those changes, the highs, the lows, the surprises, what to expect, and maybe what not to expect. This episode, I'm catching up with our regular panellists, Tim Tenbensel, health policy researcher at Auckland University, and Gabrielle Baker, independent health researcher. Kia ora, dear panellists, Gabrielle and Tim, and welcome back to System Fix. We've had a bit of a break since we last talked 4 weeks ago, partly due to all those wonderful public holidays we've been having. And then there was the COVID outbreak and our level 3 alert here in Auckland. Through all this, we have to assume the health sector changes continue to roll on, though still pretty quiet on that front. At the end of January, I co-hosted a popcorn panel with Jim Voas. Tim was one of our panellists, along with Sharon Shea, who was on the Māori Expert Advisory Group to the Health and Disability Sector Review, and Simon Royal, Chief Executive of the National Hauora Coalition. It was a really well-attended Zoom discussion on how a Māori health authority with commissioning powers might work, and there was definitely an air of expectation that there may be some sort of announcement at Waitangi relating to that agency, but that didn't happen. Elsewhere, a primary care transformation team at the Ministry of Health has been set up and appears to be receiving submissions on how people might want to see change in the sector. We know, for instance, that Nick Chamberlain at Northland DHB has said that the DHB has put forward a submission that they could contract directly with GPs in the area. That transformation team is not to be confused with the transition unit being run by Stephen McKernan out of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet, though confusion is certainly possible, because one would think that Stephen might be accepting similar kinds of submissions. Nothing formal has been heard from this unit. Also in the Ministry of Health, the Director General Ashley Bloomfield has set up a general practice sector group with a view to improving communication around COVID-19 and also communication around pending decisions on the Health and Disability Sector Review. It's got a pretty gnarly lineup, this new group, including the DHB primary care trio of Nick Chamberlain, Kiriana Brooking, and Cathy O'Malley. There's a heck of a lot of knowledge in primary care in those three people. From the sector, we've got Jeff Lowe, Rory McCree-Jansen, Rachel Thompson, Celeste Glimmer, Samantha Merton, Joe Talarico, and Joe Scott-Jones, and a number of people from the ministry, including Don Matheson as co-chair of that group with Ashley Bloomfield. This is great news for general practice, but it must leave other primary care providers, such as midwives and pharmacists, feeling a little bit out in the cold, because they also have quite a significant role in the vaccine response for COVID and also in the way primary care might look under sector reform. More broadly in the sector, we've seen three large primary health organisations lose their chief executives. Maybe not lose them, but their chief executives have chosen to move on. John Ross of Comprehensive Care announced he is leaving after more than 10 years at that North Shore PHO. Wayne Woolridge is leaving Health Hawke's Bay after 3 years. And ProCare's new chief executive, Bindi Norwell, began early this year. And then there was the report from County's Manukau DHB suggesting the DHB might like to look at buying practices and pharmacies in its area. This was suggested to prevent practices and pharmacies that were struggling being bought up by corporates who might themselves be subject to financial mishap. Ironically, the report also commended those corporates for being flexible in their response to COVID. So that's kind of in a nutshell what we've seen recently. So it's sort of like not much has really happened on the surface, but a lot seems to be happening behind the scenes. So Tim and Gabrielle, any thoughts on what we've just gone over there?
Yes, there was lots of what you were saying there and summing up very well, I think, the last few weeks. Thank you. I think one of the things I've observed is that I'm not seeing a lot of tangible stuff, but I know things are happening. Yes. So I feel like every time I walk outside my door, I find somebody who's willing to tell me that they've heard something or that they know something. And that always just makes me a little bit nervous, actually, because my nervousness is that what I'm hearing is more and more that sense of the people who are already in power continuing to be decision makers our brokers and what could be a transformational change that leads us to a more equitable health and disability system. So by that, I mean that I'm hearing people tell me that they know who, for example, has already been selected to be a board of a Māori health authority and those kind of things, which, just to echo points I made last time, those kind of decisions, if they're going to be made well, won't have happened yet. There's still that the sense of jockeying for position and everybody wanting to be in the tent, but in a way that it's the same old to me.
I found that really interesting in the last podcast when you talked around that, those power issues and how easy it is to actually move a huge system like this into thinking outside of the tent. And as you say, if the same people are jockeying for positions, there has to be a very strong political determination to really change. And what really concerns me, I suppose, is if that was the case, I would expect there to be a bit more public discussion, an openness to discuss a bit more publicly what the thinking is, rather than the idea that maybe in March sometime we're going to get a feel for what the legislative changes might be. I think when Martin Johnson interviewed Andrew Little earlier in this year, and that interview was on one of our podcasts, he implied that there may be more engagement with the sector in the coming weeks, and those coming weeks are kind of now. I feel like if you're going to have significant transformational change, that's a real journey. People should be involved now. It shouldn't be, as you say, you step out the door and someone says in passing, oh, did you know? It should be a little bit more overt than that. Or am I just dreaming? Tim?
Thanks, Barbara. Yeah, I think this tells us a lot about big policy-making processes in the health sector in New Zealand, and we're a small country. And this shows that a level of informality about this and people knowing people and trusting or not trusting, or which can be a strength in some ways and can be a weakness in the way that Gabriel's, I think, outlined. And one thing that really strikes me about it is that, say, compared to larger places or bigger countries, there's no sort of formalised system for doing this. So in a lot of other countries, you'd know who the key umbrella bodies were representing GPs or representing other primary care professions or representing other important voices in society. And this is all kind of very ad hoc and hard to untangle. And it's going to be important to try and untangle it, you know, sort of in retrospect, I think, to say, what does this tell us? But, you know, who's not at the table? There's lots of interesting things that it says about the lack of role for the Primary Care Federation. Mm-hmm. You would think that they would be in here somewhere. Maybe, we don't know. It tells us a lot about the groups representing general practitioners. And it seems like it's particular individuals rather than particular groups that are sought after. So it's not the status of heading up a particular organisation, which means they're in this setup. It's just who the people are. So I think the dangers that Gabriel has talked about over these podcasts, I think, are real in that sense.
I really welcome the appointment of the general practice sector group, because in my role as editor of New Zealand Doctor Rata Aotearoa, I'm really aware of the importance of the voice of general practice, particularly with the COVID vaccine rollout, and how in the past there's been concerns about the lack of that voice. But I do kind of wonder, as you say, about the ad hoc nature, because the transition unit was set up within the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet because it was perceived that the Ministry of Health had a vested interest in the reforms because of the creation of the new Health NZ and what impact that might have on the Ministry of Health. So while I really welcome the idea that the Ministry of Health is looking at how transformation might take place in primary care, we might get better models of care and more efficient spending of money, and with the new locality services, a more egalitarian spread of money, I kind of wonder how that works with this idea that it was perceived that there was a conflict of interest. Gabrielle, you mentioned you were hearing names of people being proposed for a board of a Māori health authority. When we talked last time, you were really clear about the benefits of having a far more regional approach with the Māori health authority. So even the idea that you'd be hearing names for a board seems a little contrary to that.
It absolutely does seem contrary to that. And it reinforces the idea that there are kind of elite power makers in here. And I feel like that's an antithesis of what they're talking about as the ideal state of the health and disability system. And actually on that, I got some listener feedback on our last podcast. Like, the question was about whether or not in the discussions on an independent hauora authority or whatever it ends up being called, there was any having something counter to a Western medical model. And there had been lots of this discussion about that. Most of the discussions I've been in about a Māori health authority have said we can't buy into a Western ideal of what health or health health services looks like. We have to come from a Māori-centred approach to health and an understanding of hauora in the broadest sense. And I have to say that the rumours that I hear about people being on boards or those kind of things seem counter to that as well.
And I'm wondering, you know, if we'd be watching developments in Northland, you know, with that question in mind as well, because there, you know, there's things happening up there. Barbara's in a better position to describe them than me. But it very much speaks to that issue, Gabrielle, doesn't it? I think about how would you define the system locally if there's going to be some sort of contract arrangement between GPs and a Māori entity or Māori providers in some sense or some relationship there. What's going to frame that? You know, is it going to be traditional medical paradigm or is it going to be a much broader hauora or Māori, you know, understanding of what the purpose is?
Presumably, if the system is restructured so that a Māori health commissioning agency was put in place, that agency would be making those decisions for itself rather than being directed by whatever the plan was for the restructured system. Because otherwise, I think, as Gabrielle has said in the past, the idea, if you're, you know, truly engaging in a treaty partnership, is you don't actually set up someone to just implement what you want.
Yeah. Sorry, Gabrielle.
That's exactly right. But I will always be asking of any kind of change or any kind of policy or program development, how are they giving expression to partnership? How is this honouring the commitments in the treaty? And an ad hoc kind of approach, which is what it feels like is happening at the moment, doesn't help me to answer that question. It doesn't give me a sense of how are Māori driving things across the whole system. And actually, I think I've definitely seen and I've heard the Associate Minister, in particular Minister Henare, talking with Māori communities and groups about an independent hauora authority. And I do think that that's an important discussion. Again, it's not that kind of widespread discussion that we've talked about, but it's some discussion. That is only one piece of the puzzle for the hauora system. And I do somewhat worry that we get really captured by talking about one entity that may or may not solve the problems that it's designed to solve, and all the rest of the stuff is ignored. And I did go to Waitangi this year, but not for the big day. But it did mean I got to talk to lots of people who were there for a purpose, to talk about the partnership. And even in those discussions that we were talking about, well, what happens with hospital level services in this for Māori, if we're focusing just on a small part of the health sector funding pie, what does that mean?
And that goes back to, even in the Simpson report, the figure around the percentage of health and well-being that's actually impacted on by health services. It's quite small compared to the rest of social. So with that paper that came out from Counties Manukau DHB, it just kind of reinforces what we're going to see with regard to power and how the DHBs look at their space. Because they are government agencies, the extent to which they can actually map out any future for themselves at the moment, that would be the case, wouldn't it, Tim?
No, I think that's a good question. I mean, you know, Counties Manukau DHB may or may not continue to exist. However, I guess, you know, the other side of that is, well, what do you do in situations of uncertainty where, you know something is going to happen, but do you just stop and not do anything? I mean, I suspect that the county's paper, and I haven't had a chance to have a look at it, is part of, an internal discussion in Counties Manukau about a lot of these things and sort of the state of primary care services in South Auckland in particular. And, you know, it's not everybody's on the same page in that organisation about that. So, you know, I would see it more from that point of view, as this is sort of maybe, you know, staking out some ground that, you know, you might retreat from a bit later, but you're sort of putting a stake in the ground. That's how I read that.
Okay. A kind of general question, actually, Gabrielle, you might have a better sense of this being down in Wellington. Chris Hipkins as COVID response minister, do you have any sense of him having an active role in the reforms that are being discussed at the moment?
I actually don't have a sense of that at all, but I had assumed because a mere appointment for that very specific role meant that he didn't have to get involved in those other discussions. He'd focus just on COVID. So that was my assumption. I actually hadn't thought it through.
Because of his role in the restructuring of tertiary education services, that he might have the experience to have more of an involvement with these changes as well.
I wouldn't have thought he's got the time.
That was what I was thinking. And I mean, obviously, as a member of Cabinet, he'll be part of the decisions, but it's a big job, the one he's got.
Yeah. And it brings to mind that we still haven't got the Section 11 Oversight Committee, and it hasn't actually been appointed yet.
The other thing I've seen on end-to-end was people with lived experience with disability really pushing for more visibility of disability-related issues and going to Parliament towards the end of March to raise this, which I think is related a little bit to that second podcast of the series, but also the idea that disability doesn't seem well covered by the Health and Disability System Review and the call for a separate agency.
That's good news. It's good news that people are actually being active.
Yeah.
On, you know. What else have we got happening? Beginning to see people moving from primary health organisations. Mm. Although my feeling has been in the last month that people in primary health organisations probably feel a little bit more secure than they possibly did when the Simpson report first came out. And it was pointed out to me that for a start, at a bare minimum, you would want these organisations to continue to be involved in the payment systems for primary care or for general practice. The possibility of DHBs taking over the kind of payments that are for general practice is probably not to be welcomed. These are quite complex payment systems, and although we have capitation, we still have a lot of fee-for-service payments going on. There were problems during the early days of the CBEC getting payment on time, and also during the early days of COVID, the general practices that had new payment systems set up weren't receiving their payments from the DHBs on time. So I would think that's something that if I was a DHB, particularly a new mega DHB, taking on new payment systems, and we've seen problems with that elsewhere in the government agencies, teachers, is really something kind of keep it. So at a minimum, they have a future potentially for the medium term to keep up payments. And then we've seen Down and Capity setting up, looking at localities and being quite serious about how they're working with other primary care providers. If I was in a primary health organisation at the moment, in a medium to large sized one, I'd probably be looking around at my strengths and realising that there's actually a place for those in the future.
Yeah, I think you're right, Barbara. I don't get the sense from the people that are in, again, from the people that are involved in the reform process, for better or worse, that gunning for PHOs is top of their agenda. Just looking at the names that are in the group that Ashley Bloomfield put together, they don't seem to be either from DHBs or ministries, those sorts of people in DHBs and ministries. So I guess there's movement in key positions. There's long-serving PHO chief executives that are now departed into the sunset. That may free up, and probably has already in some parts of the country, in the north of the North Island, started to sort of change maybe the dynamics locally. And two of the ones that you mentioned earlier, Barbara, are both from big Auckland PHOs. And I think, while a lot of the relationships and the gnarliness and the frustrations are embedded institutionally in the relationships between DHBs and PHOs, particularly in Auckland and the Upper North Island, often a change at the top can be a catalyst for change in direction of those relationships. So, putting those two things together, I think there may be a new dawn in some areas.
Hmm. Okay, guys. Any predictions about what we might see in the next 4 weeks? Gabrielle?
I would be hoping that we would see some announcements about that process of how the political decisions are going to be made. So in the interview Minister Little had with NZDoc a few weeks ago, he talked about announcements towards the end of March. So between now and then, I'd want to see the engagement that was promised, for example.
Yes, that would be excellent. Tim?
Predictions. Oh, gosh. I'm not great at making predictions. Never have been. Prefer to see the dust settle and try and make sense of it, in the rear vision mirror. Look, at any time, a whole lot of stuff can happen. There's a whole lot of different possibilities out there. And that's kind of the feeling we're in at the moment, is that degree of uncertainty. And, of course, some people know a lot more about what's going to happen, but they're keeping it closer to their chest.
Now, the System Fix quiz, where I have a glance back at the Simpson report and try and catch you guys out on something that's been announced or recommended. Starting, true or false question. A public health advisory committee should not be mandatory. True or false?
I think false.
And why would that be, Tim?
Well, as I recall, the Simpson report recommended there should be something, again, fairly vague as to how it would fit in the whole architecture and whether it would be a standalone or a unit within the ministry. personally, I favour it being closer to the ministry rather than separate from it. But happy to talk about that some other time. But I know a lot of my public health colleagues disagree with that.
Great. Next question. The workforce plan should take a 10 to 15 year view, true or false?
I think that one was true.
Yes, that's
right. I'm going true on that.
I'm wondering why they would go for 10 to 15 years. What is it about workforce plans? I've been told in the past that you can never plan for workforce, and if you try, as soon as your plan is written, it's no longer relevant. Any thoughts on that?
One says that's true, but I guess the other side of it is that, you know, you need, depending on what workforce you're talking about, there's government funding of tertiary education, health professionals and other professionals. You know, that takes a while for the pipeline to come through. So from that point of view, it makes sense to be looking at that time frame. But I agree that, you know, these things, you know, we saw 7 or 8 years ago, suddenly, you know, we went from a shortage of docs to an oversupply in some sense of, you know, suddenly Australia wasn't the destination for our medical graduates. You know, that turned very quickly.
Yeah. And Australia started producing too many of its own graduates and they had to come home. Okay, now the last question is just a really tricky one. I'm going to ask you to interpret a sentence from the Simpson Report. Services should be built that enable seamless interaction between tiers 1 and 2 and supports long lining of specialist tier 2 services into tier 1 networks. And I suppose I'm asking that question because at first glance, I had not come across the word long lining before. It sounded like something I might do out in the Hauraki Gulf.
Yeah. That's where you lost me in that sentence. Like, okay, yeah, got it. Oh.
Long lining, is this some obscure policy term that we haven't heard of, Tim?
Certainly not a policy term. It may be an MBA type term. I don't know. I've never heard of it. You know, so perhaps if nobody knows what it is, then it could mean anything, which is what you want to do with that sort of statement.
Such a nonsense. Would anyone say any of the opposite with that, apart from their long lining, which I don't understand?
Yeah.
This would be true. It's one of those things where everyone can agree with it because it
means. I know. It's interesting in part of our primary care research project, you know, run out of Vic University. A lot of people we've been interviewing are kind of saying, oh, integration's sort of, so, you know, between primary and secondary or tier 1, you know, it's kind of, you know, the steam's gone out of it, the heat's gone out of it. People are sort of, you know, talking less about it now than they were 5-10 years ago. It's just kind of interesting, given that it's, you know, a fairly fundamental issue to deal with.
Yeah.
But the appetite for dealing with it within DHBs is certainly, you know, really, really waned.
Yeah. No, that's interesting. And now that the alliances are disappearing, they're going to have to create whole new mechanisms for that to happen anyway.
Well, that's why it's interesting you've got Kathy and Kerriana and Nick Chamberlain and those people and all those people that supported the development of alliances sort of in Ashley's group.
None of us passed that. It's not a one. Kia ora, and thank you so much for joining me again. And I look forward to speaking to you in another 3 or 4 weeks and seeing developments have come out of the system.
Kia ora.
Kia ora.
Thanks for listening to System Fix, brought to you by the Health Media. If you're interested in finding out more about changes to the health system, you can subscribe to New Zealand Doctor Rate Aotearoa by going to nzdoctor.co.nz, or you could also subscribe to Pharmacy Today. Go to pharmacytoday.co.nz. The Health Media also produces The Roster, Te Rārangi, a regular email newsletter providing news of people moving around the health system. Thanks again, Kia ora. I look forward to catching up with you next time.